Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
So thanks, Paul, for joining me today to talk about your book, The Art of Chinese Philosophy. So I wanted to begin by asking just kind of how you, I know you've been working on this stuff a long time, but how you came to working on Chinese philosophy in particular, and then also the project of this particular book.
How I got interested in Chinese philosophy is that I opened some books and discovered that they were very interesting, and that was the beginning of a lifetime commitment. I didn't quite expect it. I was always interested in China. So in school, I was reading a lot about Chinese history, Chinese language. And I thought I needed to read the great classical philosophers, and I never stopped. Now, how I started this book is an easier question to answer. I've been teaching an introductory seminar on Chinese thought at Penn since my very first year there. And after, more than two decades of that, I felt I had my own interpretations of all these texts. And I thought they were worth publishing. But it took a long time to write. The idea germinated probably about 15 years ago. And I thought it would be easy to write. And then I sat down and I realized that the book would be pointless unless I had something new to say. And for vast stretches, I didn't yet. So I took my time. And I'm glad I did, because at this point, I do think, like it or not, I'm the only person who could have written it. That's my perspective and my perspective only. And 15 years ago, I would have borrowed more from other people.
So what guided your choice of text for this book in particular? So the selection of texts, I know you do some of the standard, like the Analects, the Tao Te Ching, things like that. But why these texts in specific?
So I think those are the eight most important ones. I didn't have a set number, but eight does work. And, my criteria are they constantly refer to one another, either directly or through, unmistakable allusions or problematizing a philosophical position that would have been apparent to any ancient reader is coming from this other text. Some of them are known from tombs. Some of them are rare in tombs. But I don't think anyone would argue with those eight. You could add a ninth, but I don't know which one it would be. Whichever text comes in ninth on the list of the most influential classical philosophical texts is miles behind number eight. There are some other military texts, but philosophically, I think Sun Tzu is the most original of them. That's probably the most unconventional choice. But I think it's important. It's partaking of the same philosophical discourse. I think it's aimed at very similar readers. It's a magnificent book. The Chinese of Sun Tzu is among, the greatest. It's about the greatest Chinese you'll ever read. So I felt I had to include that one. And students have always loved it. It's short and philosophically maybe not quite as deep as the other seven. But I think it qualifies as a philosophical text. And as I said, it's certainly participating in that discourse. It's using the vocabulary. It's playing the rules of the game to present a perspective on philosophy that comes from military point of view. So those eight weren't hard to choose. And then dividing them into three sections wasn't really hard either. So you have what I think are the three oldest of the eight. And what they have in common is that they do not yet have a concept of the Tao as a cosmological notion. They'll use the word Tao, but in a sort of benign sense of the right way to act. In Muozi, actually, it's not even necessarily the right way to act. It's just the way someone acts. Could be right, could be wrong. And then there's three in the middle, Lao Tzu, and Sunzi, which all seem to be aware of this new interpretation of Tao as the cosmic order or something like that. And then there are two at the end of this period. I called them two titans at the end of an age because they both look back on everything that's been achieved over the 2 to 2.5 centuries before they were working. That's Xunzi and Han Feizi. And they're also aware that this period of political disunion is coming to an end, and they're presaging what kind of world they think will and should succeed it. So choosing the eight wasn't that hard, and dividing them into three sections wasn't that hard either.
So one of the things you talk about in the first chapter is the nature of these texts. You talk about things like the importance of the commentarial tradition, which is really interesting, and the kind of the differences between these texts and things that you see in certainly kind of like more modern Western thought. What do you think the nature of these texts is compared to some of the things that people may be more familiar with in the West, such as like the ancient Greek text?
Well, they're closer to ancient Greek texts than to something like Hume or Kant. The main contrast I was making in that chapter is with texts that we read in a philosophy class, where we don't have any significant dispute about authorship, whereas all eight of these texts are authorless, both literally and figuratively. Xunzi and Han Feizi probably wrote the bulk of the material that's in the texts that bear their name, but they didn't write the book as a book. In both cases, somebody later, in the case of Xunzi, we know who, in the case of Han Feizi, we don't know who, but in both cases, somebody later gathered together the writings and edited into a book. And for the first six, we don't even have that. I really don't think texts like Zhuangzi or Laozi can be attributed to a single author. They're more like the products of a long tradition. I think that's the same for Muozi too. So that's a big difference, and it affects our interpretation. We can't appeal to knowledge about the author. We even have to think twice about appealing to coherence if it's not to be taken for granted that a single mind produced these texts. The contrast with ancient Greece is harder for me to comment on. I'm not a specialist on Greek philosophy. I think there's going to be more similarities there. For example, with the dialogues of Plato, but a big difference in the Chinese case, and something I mentioned, I felt that philosophers might roll their eyes, but it is important. It's the significance of the palace library as an institution. A large percentage of the texts that we read from Chinese antiquity, and therefore a large percentage of the philosophical texts, went through a kind of an editing process that was pretty systematic at the Imperial Library. Soon after, within 200 years of the end of this period. I don't think there's any analog for that in the Greco-Roman world. There's a Roman Empire, but, I don't want to talk through my hat, because again, that's not my area of expertise, but I don't think there's a single Imperial Library in the ancient Mediterranean world that had such a profound impact on the production of philosophical texts.
Yeah, one of the things that's interesting about this that I always kind of think of as somewhat similar is the commentarial tradition in ancient Indian texts, right? Because there, right, oftentimes you need the commentary to understand at all what's going on with the original text, a sutra or something like this. And here, I think a lot of people, a lot of philosophers in particular, don't often look to the commentarial tradition connected to some of these texts because they can be understood as more standalone. What's your view on the commentarial tradition in that sense? Do you think it's necessary for us to understand these texts, or is it extraneous? Or
certainly not extraneous. And this is a big quarrel that I've had with people in the Chinese philosophy field. The distinction between text and commentary for some of these texts is imaginary. So Lao Tzu, again, before the Wangbi commentary that pretty much set it in stone, Lao Tzu would have been transmitted with a commentary, because otherwise you don't know which tradition of Lao Tzu you're talking about. It's the commentary that determines the tradition, and the differences in the interpretations of these traditions, but sometimes also the differences in the wording, are pretty significant. So there really is no such thing as the Lao Tzu. If anybody tells you, you know, the philosophy of Lao Tzu, you got to say, time out, which Lao Tzu? And I don't think philosophers are in the habit of doing that. I think they're in the habit of reading Lao Tzu again as though it were, you know, some kind of authorized, pristine text without any textual problems. And the commentaries are just the accumulated opinions of various people, which you can, you know, accept or not accept, or read, or choose to ignore. But for Chinese, for some classical Chinese texts, Lao Tzu is a good example. You just can't do that because the commentary is the, let's call it the tissue of the tradition that produced and preserved the text in the first place. If you cut that all out, you have something that's rootless and not the way the text was intended to be received. A quick look at history. I mentioned this in the chapter also. It explains why we have these commentaries, and that is that the texts were usually written with underdetermined graphs, or they would have been simply memorized, you know, without any, without any need for a written document. And sometimes the graphs are ambiguous. Sometimes they're open to multiple interpretation. Or if you memorize a verse, right, sometimes there's a homophone, or sometimes a phrase could be understood in different ways. I think what's going on is that in earlier periods, you would learn this text with a master who would explain to you orally what's going on in each line. Oh, this graph, well, our tradition understands it in this way. Oh, this line, you probably don't know what that means. Well, our tradition understands it in this way. And again, this is related to the impact of the empire on the production of Chinese philosophy. With that new society, the modes of transmitting texts changed. And your exposure to a text like this didn't necessarily come through direct oral instruction at the feet of a master anymore. So you needed something to make up for that. Because otherwise the text has no anchor. And that was the commentary. The commentary tells you, oh, this graph, you're probably wondering what it is, since it can be read in five different ways. Oh, well, we read it this way. And no single commentary is necessarily authoritative, because they all represent a distinctive perspective. But ignoring those is, to borrow shamelessly a metaphor from Confucius, to look at one corner and ignore the other three.
Right, right. So one thing you talk about is the way the kind of these the Chinese philosophical texts have been received in the West and our philosophical tradition. And one of the really interesting things I think that you talked about early on was this idea of the role of deductive argument, and how you don't really find this so much in the early Chinese texts. Do you think this is the main kind of reason for the kind of historic neglect of Chinese philosophy as philosophy in our tradition?
I certainly think it's one reason. Another big reason is sort of like the self-confirming biases of Western philosophy. We decide what philosophy is on the basis of certain Western texts and traditions. And then we look around in the rest of the world, and whatever seems to conform, okay, that's philosophy too. But it's not necessarily as good because it's fitting an alien definition. And that method also excludes a lot of rich philosophy that's happening in other traditions that isn't beholden to, you know, Western definitions and priorities. So I've always been allergic to that regimen. But I agree with you that the prevalence of non-deductive arguments in classical Chinese philosophy has alienated some Western readers. And to me, the dead giveaway is that in the late 19th and early 20th century, when Chinese intellectuals themselves were dealing with the crisis of modernity, the impending crash of the imperial system, and so on, and one of their programs was to go back and take stock of Chinese history and see whether there are any traditions that are logical or philosophical or that, you know, that would pass muster according to European definitions. And they started wringing their hands because they didn't find much. Well, to me, that's the giveaway. And one of the things that they would wring their hands about was that, you know, we don't have deductive thinking. We don't have logical thinking. We don't have syllogisms. There's no, you don't even have a pre-modern Chinese word for syllogism. To me, that argument falls flat. There's no pre-modern Chinese word for religion. There's no pre-modern Chinese word for philosophy. That's a very limited argument. But you can understand why in the period from like 1870 to 1920, roughly speaking, that seemed to be particularly urgent. So one of the things they focused on was that China didn't have, you know, something like the Aristotle's exposition of syllogism and so on. So I think it's one reason. I'm not going to say it's the only reason. And of course, I make the point in that chapter. I'm not saying that there's no deductive reasoning in Chinese philosophy either. There are quite a few examples of it, and that's important to remember because it refutes the canard that classical Chinese philosophers were incapable of deductive reasoning. Okay, they weren't capable of it. They could put together nice deductive arguments, and I gave a few examples. A couple of them are pretty complex. So when they chose, other kinds of arguments, that was a real choice. It's not because they weren't capable of deductive reasoning. There must be some reasons why they chose other kinds of argumentative forms, and that's behind the title, The Art of Chinese Philosophy. I think reading and interpreting Chinese philosophy is an art, and my approach to it is more like my approach to interpreting a poem or a painting than interpreting a modern philosophical text, where I don't usually expect to find much artistry, and where I usually blame the author if I don't find the argument impressive. Whereas the expectation in the case of Chinese philosophy is that if you don't find the argument impressive, well, maybe your first instinct shouldn't be to blame the author. Maybe you need to, again, to borrow shamelessly a metaphor from Confucius, turn around and seek the reason in yourself.
Right. One of the interesting things about deductive argument, I think we could say, I mean, it's hard to associate it with philosophy in particular, because a lot of the people in Western philosophy too, I mean, there's a lot of texts where we don't find deductive argument in the Western tradition that still gets accepted as philosophy. If we look at like work of Friedrich Nietzsche or something like this, right? You don't find a whole lot of deductive argument, but it's still accepted, right, as philosophical.
Oh, I wholeheartedly agree. The notion that philosophy is the same thing as deductive reasoning, that was obsolete a couple thousand years ago. But in the 19th century, you know, there are real examples you can point to where, you know, both Chinese and Western intellectuals are, you know, bemoaning the scarcity of deductive reasoning in the Chinese tradition and asking in all seriousness whether that's a reason for China's decline in the 19th century. It's pretty absurd, but it's not the only absurd idea that came out of the 19th century.
Right. So I want to go back to this distinction you make, which I thought was a really interesting one between the philosophy of heaven and philosophy of the way, this kind of these two sections that you set up. And it was interesting, the text you selected for that and how you talked about how this conception of heaven and the way emerge in each of those texts and sections. I wondered if you could just talk a little bit more about the ways in which this notion of heaven emerges in these particular three texts, and the way that the notion of the way, or particular understanding of the way, emerges in the text that you talk about in that second section.
We understand, it's a paradox, we understand the history of heaven a little bit better than we understand the history of the way, even though heaven is the much older concept. So heaven goes back to the Bronze Age. That's very clear from Bronze Age documents. And, you know, even in the Shang Dynasty, the cliche is, well, the Shang had no concept of heaven, but they had a concept of Di, which is like the deity, or Shang Di, which is like the supreme deity. And there are oracle bone inscriptions that describe the actions of Di in a way that's pretty similar to the way in the later Bronze Age inscriptions and texts refer to heaven as an impersonal force whose will affects the course of events on Earth. So heaven is a pretty old notion. And what's going on, by and large, in the philosophy of heaven books, which I identified as the Analects, Muozzo, and Mencius, is to try to philosophize a very old concept. Mencius, in particular, is the most skeptical of the three. So Mencius doesn't deny that there's a heaven. Mencius even says there's all kinds of things that happen even though no human being brought it about. How do we explain that? It must be heaven. But Mencius is also frustrated. Heaven's not behaving the way it should. Why do we have, you know, such political chaos and immorality in society? Why is heaven allowing this? And also, there seemed to have been a belief in a 500-year cycle of sage kings. This is probably related to a kind of an astronomical accident, which is that roughly once every 500 years, it's not a period because it's not a single astronomical event, but roughly every 500 years, there seems to be a spectacular agglomeration of planets in a single portion of the sky. And before Facebook and before light pollution and before Netflix, people observed the sky more carefully than they do today. So something like that would have really stood out to them. And, you know, it's in the sky. So, so the idea that it's a sign from heaven is a pretty obvious inference to make. And that's supposed to happen every 500 years. And it's supposed to be an omen that a sage king is about to arise. And by Mencius's time, it's been more than 700 years, and he even says, what's going on? There's supposed to be a 500-year cycle. He doesn't go so far as to say, you know, heaven, you promised us. But he says that the only inference we can make is that heaven doesn't yet want a sage king. Heaven doesn't yet want peace. The other inference we can make is that if you do 500 years from the previous one was roughly 1050-ish. If you do 500 years from there, that's very, very close to the birthday of Confucius. So that offhand comment in Mencius that more than 500 years have gone by, there's been no sage king, is also probably the beginning of the whole uncrowned king legend that Confucius should have been a sage. He was born at exactly the right time. He exhibited all of the behavior that you'd expect of a sage, but he couldn't become a king for whatever reason, and Mencius is implying it's because heaven didn't want him to be. Heaven wanted us to suffer. You know, Mencius doesn't give any direct answer. That's why I say Mencius is the most skeptical of the three. Heaven must want us to keep suffering for a couple more centuries. There's no other explanation.
Right.
The Tao, You also asked me about the Tao. One's harder to pinpoint. So sometime in the fourth century, we see it's not in a single tradition, but it's a new, let's say, a new understanding of a pretty old word. This old word Tao, which means road. It had, like the Greek word hodos, it had come to mean like the right path, the right way to proceed. So you find even Confucius saying it in the Analects, and he's not talking about, the Tao as the cosmological pattern. He's talking about the Tao as, you know, good, right conduct, something like that. And then the fourth century, we start to see a bunch of different texts exploring a different, understanding of Tao as more than just the right path, but actually the fundamental pattern of the universe. So that understanding this Tao will empower you to understand the way the universe works, and of course make you a formidable person, because you, armed with an understanding of the universe, will be competing with, you know, all kinds of fools who think they understand the universe by going to Confucian school. And all their, you know, all they learn is foolishness. So it's very clear in Lao Tzu. And another indication that this is aimed at countering the supremacy of Confucian thinking is that in Lao Tzu, the Tao comes first. The Tao is the mother. The Tao produces everything, including heaven. Confucians never accept that. So when Xunzi, who's quite comfortable with using the Tao in the sense of the fundamental pattern, timeless, unchanging, can be learned, can be observed, and so on. In Xunzi, it's the other way around. In Xunzi, heaven produces the Tao. So even though Xunzi comes at the very end of this period, he's not willing to relinquish the idea that that heaven is supreme, heaven comes first, and he sees the utility of a concept like the Tao, but he doesn't go as, he's not willing to go as far as a tradition like Lao Tzu, or I think implicitly Zhuangzi, in saying that heaven is just a child of the Tao, like everything else in the universe.
Mm-hmm. So one of the in the first kind of chapter that here that you talk about these texts, you discuss the Analects, and this is I found an interesting chapter because this is one of those texts that I always thought was kind of very misunderstood by philosophers. And could you talk a little bit about what you take to be its role in the early philosophical tradition? Because what you often see, right, is this idea that you've got this first philosophical text, and here's the kind of like something that's giving you a kind of a overview of early Chinese philosophy and the first kind of philosophical account of some of these ideas. What do you think is going on in the Analects?
So one problem that I do take seriously is that I'm not so sure that it's the first philosophical text.
Exactly.
There are people in the early China field who are not usually philosophers who point out that there isn't very good evidence that the text existed before the Han Dynasty. And pretty early in the Han Dynasty, but Han Dynasty nonetheless. And that's an important point. It means that you can't think of the Analects as the textual fountainhead. However, I've written a controversial paper about this, and I think my position is the better one. However, I think the ideas and possibly, you know, even the material in this Han Dynasty compilation called the Analects, the Selected Sayings of Confucius, is truly old. So what I think is going on there, again, we're talking about the impact of the empire. The old mode of learning, you know, with a Confucian master isn't feasible anymore. So people think, hey, we better write this down. Otherwise, it, you know, might get lost. They seem to write it down first for the benefit of the crown prince. That's where the text seems to originate. But I believe that the ideas are truly old, and some of them, you know, to the best of our understanding, might even go back to Confucius himself. I don't know how we would verify that. But the concerns seem like the concerns of Confucius's era. And there's a lot of Han Dynasty concerns, like omens and, you know, how to organize an empire, ritual divisions, and so on, that the Analects really doesn't get into. So it doesn't seem to make too much sense as a Han Dynasty text. So I think these are teachings that were well known in Confucian lineages and Confucian schools, but had never been collected and put in writing comprehensively, because there had never been a need for that if you wanted to learn the Confucian traditions. And remember, the Analects is never just the Analects of Confucius. It's the Analects of Confucius and his disciples. There's plenty of passages in the Analects where it's a disciple speaking, and yet that's ratified by the tradition as almost as good as the words of Confucius himself, because they make it into the text. And there are cases where the disciples say something and Confucius is like, no, think through what you're saying, and gives a pithy response that explains what's wrong with what the disciple said. So, before it was written down, there wasn't a need, because if you wanted to learn that tradition, there'd be masters running around and you could attach yourself to one and then you would become equipped too after a course of oral instruction. There's plenty of evidence that there were, master-disciple relationships. That's not simply a figment of the tradition. But then there came a time, I think, when that method of instruction didn't work anymore. And then I think people said, well, now we need to write it down.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So what do you think? One of the ways that this is commonly, the NLX is commonly presented, and I've done it like this sometimes myself, is to say, okay, let's take all these concepts. You know, we talk about Ren and Li and all these other concepts and see that as what the NLX is trying to instruct us about, right? Do you think this was intended to be read? Do you think it was intended to be read in this way where we have all these concepts and we're trying to figure out what these concepts are, or is there something else going on here?
That's certainly part of it, and one proof that's part of it is that there'll be a case where a disciple runs up and says, "Hey, Confucius, is the following Ren?" and gives some horribly overblown definition, and then Confucius, also another indirect indication that Confucius thinks Ren, which I translate as humanity, is a very important concept, is that he never defines it. Anything really important, he doesn't define. And that, I think, gets to the main purpose of the Analects, which is to get people to think for themselves. And that's related to what I meant just now by philosophizing the concept of heaven. In the Bronze Age, the will of heaven, or the will of the ancestors, or the will of the spirits, this deity that I mentioned, that could be ascertained through a divination. Whether it was oracle bone divination or other types of divination that were practiced. And we don't know whether anybody in the Bronze Age doubted this, but if they did, their words were not transmitted. All we have from the Bronze Age are pretty confident assertions or representations of this kind of thought system in action. Let's consult the spirits. Let's consult a diviner. Let's consult the oracle bone. And Confucius, I think understanding the Analects helps a lot if you start with Confucius saying, that's not working too well. We've been doing this ghost thing for a few centuries now, and you know, Confucius doesn't say this explicitly, but I think it's hovering over the whole book, and it helps explain a lot of what's going on in the book. He doesn't deny that there are ghosts and spirits, but they're not too helpful. They don't help you decide what's the right course of action. They don't help you decide what's moral, what's immoral. We've been doing it for a long time, and the results haven't been very good. So Confucius is saying, well, let's try another way. Let's try doing the moral reasoning on our own and leave the spirits alone. Respect Jingwishan, our Yuanzhi, respect the ghosts and spirits, but keep them at a distance. They're not helpful for the project that we want to pursue, which is pretty clearly building a moral society with a sage king at the top. If the ghosts and spirits could help with that, terrific. But they don't seem to. That prompted a response almost immediately from Moists, who are sort of a reassertion of this older idea that you cannot have a flourishing moral society with a sage king at the top unless you accept the role of the spirits. So that's possibly the very first controversy in Chinese philosophy. Do we need to worry about what the ghosts think or not? The revolution of Confucius and his disciples is they haven't been helpful. Let's try another approach. And the conservative response on the part of Moists is this is heresy. You're going to go down in flames if you ignore the wishes of ghosts and spirits.
This is interesting too, because usually it's the Confucians who are kind of placed as the traditionalists, and the Moists who are seen, and they are in some ways, and the Moists who are seen as kind of like disrupting this. Whereas here, in this notion of on this view of ghosts, it's really the Moists who are kind of arguing for the traditional view.
Yeah, Moists were revolutionary in other areas, but in their belief in ghosts, they may as well have been in the Bronze Age.
Right. One of the things you talk about in the chapter on the Muozi, by the way, is this connection. You talk about a connection between the Muozi and Taoist groups, which I found very interesting. Could you say a little bit about that connection, about how what this connection is?
So there's this tradition that Muozi became an immortal. And I suspect the only reason why we have the text is because of that tradition. So why do we have the text Muozi? It's because it was preserved in the Taoist canon. If it hadn't been preserved in the Taoist canon, Muozi today would survive only in fragments and hyper-partisan fragments, because the school wasn't represented by any friends after it melted. And why was a text like Muozi included in the Taoist canon? My suspicion is that it's almost solely because of this tradition that Muozi became an immortal. And I have the same theory for Huainanzi. Why do we have Huainanzi? Well, it's in the Taoist canon. And why is it in the Taoist canon? Because of the tradition that Liaoan, the prince of Huainan, became an immortal. So I think one of the principles of inclusion, there are many in long and complex canon, but one of the principles of inclusion is if it's a text attributed to an immortal, it's got to go in. Now, for philosophers and intellectual historians, the interesting question is, where did we get this idea that Muozi became an immortal? And there's one particularly revealing, you know, hagiographical account that says, you know, Muozi was sort of hanging out in the wilderness, and an emissary from heaven came down and handed him some rare and secret scriptures. That's not a Moist idea. That's a Taoist idea, this idea of, you know, just revelation of, you know, celestial scriptures through a kind of an angel or a celestial emissary. It's speculative, but the account that I gave in that chapter is, well, what kind of a world do the Moists want? They want a world where heaven chooses its representative, who's the king, and that's the most virtuous person, and that person chooses the next most moral people, and those are the three dukes or the three patriarchs, however you want to translate that. And then they choose the next nine, and then they choose the territorial lords, and you know, all the way down. So it's a pyramid of morality, with the most moral person on top, all the way down to the bottom, who are just ordinary people like us. And the whole system is enforced by a constabulary, demonic, police force. That's pretty clear in Mohism, and that's pretty clear in Celestial Master Taoism too. If you want to redress a wrong, or repent, or appeal that your case is unfair, then you have to find a Taoist priest who can intercede in the celestial bureaucracy on your behalf. Well, there's no classical philosophical tradition remotely like that, except Mohism. It's not all that different from Mohism. There are obviously some differences. Taoism is much later. Taoism is more complex because it comprises more texts and traditions, and it lasts a much longer time. So I'm not saying that Mohism is just Taoism before Taoism. But of all the classical antecedents, if you're a religious Taoist, the one that looks the least unfamiliar to you, the most like your perspective, is that of the Mohists. So that may be behind this idea that Muanzi was chosen. Not even Zhuangzi. Muanzi is chosen to ascend to Taoist heights that even figures that we tend to associate as patron saints of Taoism, that they aren't even admitted to. Muanzi is accepted to a pretty high position.
See, you talk a bit about the Laozi in chapter 5, and you mentioned this a little bit earlier in our discussion, but how this is a kind of different kind of text than the other ones that you discuss in the book, in part because of this kind of composite nature of it, and the idea that there are a number of different versions of this. What do you think is going on there? Are they drawing on a kind of earlier tradition, or why are there this variety of different texts, and what's the purpose of that?
If I could go back to Muanzi just for one second, I'll be glad to talk about Laozi. When I mentioned that the book took me a while to write, I had to sit and think for a while because I wanted to make sure I had an original perspective on everything. Muanzi is a good example. And a lot of people have read that chapter and they say, oh, I hate it. Well, why do you hate it? Well, it's not charitable. You make them out to seem like they're these Bronze Age superstitious, credulous, whatever. Okay, be that as it may, what's distinctive about that chapter is that I don't emphasize utilitarianism. So, I go through the passages in Muanzi that people have compared to Bentham and that people use as a kind of basis for reconstructing a Mohist consequentialism. And that's undeniable. I'm not saying that's an incorrect reading. I'm saying it's an incomplete reading. You're not really getting the full dose of Mohism, especially what Mohism meant to its practitioners and to its opponents, unless you take this business of ghosts seriously. That I think is pretty important. I remember attending a lecture at my university's philosophy department. I was one of the few I've ever attended. And this was a speaker who's quite an accomplished scholar of Chinese philosophy, who was talking about how you can include Chinese philosophy into your curriculum. And he said, oh, to Mohists, then, that's utilitarianism. And I didn't get a chance to speak, but I remember thinking, yeah, no, that's like a quarter at most of Mohism. But it's a good example of what I was mentioning, earlier. You cut out the part that seems to conform to, ideas and notions and priorities that Western philosophers privilege, and you just leave aside everything else. And everything else in this case is significant. Now, you may not like it, I wouldn't enjoy living in the Bronze Age either, but it's part of the tradition. Right. And you're misrepresenting it if you just ignore it. Okay, go on.
No, go ahead.
I was going to move on to Lao Tzu. So if you had a...
So I was saying, interestingly, in philosophy, we sometimes do that with Western texts too, right? We do that with Plato as well, right? We cut all these things out where we think he's doing kind of arguments that are really philosophy. And then all the other stuff that's like mysticism or religion, we just kind of ignore that, right?
That's a very good point. And historians call that presentism,
right.
Where you go back and you rummage through all the stuff that seems to relate to you in 2020, today, right. November 29th, 2020, and everything else, not relevant. And that is so misguided because, you know, on November 30th, 2020, the present won't be exactly the same anymore and probably be largely the same, but just think of how much our political culture has changed over the last 5 years. The present does change.
Exactly.
And if your engagement with the past is solely conditioned by the concerns of the moment, then my view is you're deliberately ignoring, you know, willfully ignoring much of what the past has to teach us.
Absolutely. That's what we're misunderstanding the arguments that were there because we're neglecting all the other things they had to say. Absolutely.
So why is Lao Tzu a different text? It's a wonderful question. I wish we knew the answer. We don't have enough, the only way we could answer that question with certainty is to know exactly how the text came into being, and we don't. It's certainly not written by a wise old man named Lao Tzu. That's not believable. The Guodian manuscripts, which were excavated quite a while ago already, almost 30 years ago, they gave us a tantalizing snapshot. These were texts that were included in a small tomb, maybe the tomb of some kind of teacher, low-level aristocrat. Problem is that the tomb had been looted, so we don't know too much about it. But it includes three short, I guess I would call them, bouquets of verses that are now included in the 81 chapter Lao Tzu. So what does it mean? Does it mean that the 81 chapter Lao Tzu is the result of a process of accretion? And back at the time of the Guodian tomb, which is about 300 BC, it hadn't, fully formed yet? Or does it mean that someone around 300 BC deliberately selected his or her favorite flowers from a larger collection and, presented it as three little bouquets? I personally lean toward the former of the two explanations, which is that, of all the classical texts, the one whose genesis seems to be most compatible with a theory of accretion is that of Lao Tzu. So I'm inclined to think this means that in 300 BC, the text hadn't fully formed yet, and it was still growing, because then, just a couple generations later, when we get to the time of Han Feizi, in Jielao and Yulao, whoever wrote them, Han Fei or not, there seems to be a larger text already. So there seems to be some growth between 300 and whenever you want to date the Yulao and Jielao chapters, probably 2 to 3 generations later. Not much more than that, because they in turn seem to be older than Ma Wangui, which has a pretty firm date in the second century BC. So it looks like the sort of nascent growing product of a very different philosophical tradition, as I said, one that is trying to dethrone Confucius, destabilize that whole tradition, and argue that they are giving you a contrived view of the universe. Instead of accepting nature in all of its terrifying brutality.
So one of the things that I really wanted to ask you about, one of my favorite parts of the book was in the chapter on Xunzi, where you talk about this this view that that Xing, human nature, or inborn characteristics, is are evil in Xunzi. as what you called a quote intellectual cul-de-sac, which I thought was a great phrase, and this kind of obsession with this and the reduction of Shunza's view to that you tend to see. And you talk about it in terms of the early text, but I found this also to be the case with a lot of Western philosophical engagement with Shunza, right? Sometimes you'll see this come up in discussions of Shunza or in courses or something like this, where the only thing you'll see in covering Shunza is this view that Xing is evil. Why do you think this happens? And how does this hold us back from understanding what's going on in the Shunza in general?
It happens because Neo-Confucians used Shunza as a foil. Neo-Confucians were almost exclusively Neo-Mencians. And what was Shunza most famous for? He was most famous for criticizing Mencius's theory of human nature, which is much more complex than human nature is good. Everybody recognized that. People were not confused about what Mencius's theory meant. They knew that it was more complex than human nature is good. But then they proceeded to read Shunza as though it were no more complex than human nature is evil. And you can see this in Neo-Confucian writing, that Shunza is reduced to a foil. And I even suspect that before the Qing dynasty, not many people read Shunza because there's scarcely any commentary. Once you get to the Qing dynasty, then people who, scholars who've been liberated from Neo-Confucian biases, then they start to read Shunza seriously again. And in Tokugawa Japan, there are some good commentaries on Shunza, but in the Song and the Yuan and the Ming, there are many more commentaries on Mencius, Zhuangzi. You can get a good sense of what those philosophers were interested in. My dog is barking. She's very happy to be outside. You can get a sense of what they're reading, and it doesn't seem to be Shunza. So I even suspect that they didn't read Shunza very carefully. Maybe all they read was the Xing'e Pian, the Human Nature is Evil chapter. And I agree that it's an intellectual cul-de-sac for a couple reasons. Shunza's theory is much more complicated than that slogan. There are some people who suspect that Shunza didn't even write that chapter. I'm agnostic. But there are Chinese scholars who make the point that elsewhere in Shunza, you don't find this phrase, human nature is evil. You find more nuanced claims. Human nature is uncarved. Human nature is malleable, which are closer to what Shunza really believed. And so it's been an intellectual cul-de-sac because it's attracted so much attention. It has served to denigrate Shunza, right? Why would you emphasize this? Well, only in order to show that Shunza is not as good as Mencius. If you're a Neo-Confucian, and it has led to ignoring, the really interesting chapters like the Discourse on Heaven, Discourse on Rites, Discourse on Music, however you want to translate Jiabi, resolving obsession or resolving obscurity, something like that. But, Shunza is not the only text for which we've had some unfortunate intellectual cul-de-sacs. I think in the case of Mohism, utilitarianism has been an intellectual cul-de-sac. It's a little bit richer, but it has also served to help people not read the rest of the book.
Right. So one of my other kind of favorite parts of the book is actually your book is actually the appendix where you've got this interesting discussion of the concept of qi. Qi is one of those things like the longer I work on Chinese philosophy, the more convinced I become that qi is like the central concept. Right? I've been working recently on the Han Dynasty medical text, and you talk about the different ways that this concept is understood in the early texts and why it was seen as a particularly valuable concept in early China. Could you say a bit about this kind of role of qi in early Chinese?
So there were a couple of reasons why I felt I had to write that. One of them is related to one of the two projects I'm working on now, which is to bring to bear the tremendous gains in linguistics on our understanding of Chinese philosophy. Most people read Chinese philosophical texts with a linguistic awareness from about 1950. And over the last generation, I mean, it's really been heroic. A pretty small number of linguists have dramatically helped us understand how the old Chinese language worked, how it sounded, what its syllabic system, and so on. And qi is a good example of this. Part of the reason why you get so many different translations of qi is that people have been trying to define Chinese philosophical terms entirely by usage without considering etymology. And that's because until the present generation, there was no etymology to speak of. But you really need both. And if you just think for a minute about Greek philosophical terms, even Sanskrit philosophical terms, which can be much more complicated, usually the etymology is not in doubt. It's very rare that we come across, you know, a Greek or German or German, forget it. It's never happens. Or even Sanskrit philosophical term, and we just throw up our hands and say we don't know where the word comes from. You know, we always know where the word comes from. Well, qi is a good case where knowing where the word comes from helps. And there's no doubt anymore that it comes from the word for breath. So then you can start to organize all of the different meanings that have arisen. And I'm not denying that there have been all these various senses. Of course, there have been. But it's a jumble without knowing that etymologically, there's no doubt that it's derived from the word for breath. So that explains its significance in medical texts, precisely as you say. Now, why was it a good idea? A couple of reasons, but one of them was to help in this project of de-ghosting society. A lot of the explanations for which qi was pressed into service, or a lot of the areas in need of explanation, let's put it that way, for which qi was placed into service, had previously been explained by referring to ghosts. So in the case of medicine, illness. Why are you sick? Well, there may have been multiple reasons. There may have been multiple reasons. Our sources are limited. But the theory that's best attested, the Bronze Age, very ancient theory that's best attested, is it's because a spirit has it out for you. The spirit is offended. One of the things we have to do is find out which spirit it is so that we can try to guess what the spirit is so unhappy about. Maybe the sacrifices haven't been up to par, or maybe the king's conduct hasn't been praiseworthy. And, you know, there are a number of different sort of imagined mechanics the spirit could invade your body, or the spirit could send some other spirit, like a demon, to invade your body. And the idea of qi was, well, maybe we can come up with an explanation that doesn't rely so much on spirits. Maybe we can think of the body as a physical system. And if something goes out of whack with the substance of your body, or the balances of the different aspects of qi, because almost as soon as we have the concept of qi, we have different theories about the different types of qi, the different aspects of qi. And those are not identical. There are different theories about how this works. But that led to the idea that health is the result of a good balance of a healthy store of qi. And if the qi becomes unhealthy, where the different aspects are not properly balanced, then that's what's causing disease, not some demon, not some irate spirit. And immediately you can see how that would affect things like diet. So if different aspects of qi are found in different foods, then maybe you can use the right combination of herbs or modify your diet to restore the balance in your body. And that's one of the basic convictions of Chinese medicine, which is that you're using the medicine to restore a balance that you should have had initially, but you've lost for whatever reason.
So I wanted to ask you, we could close up, what you're working on now, what your kind of next projects are.
So two projects, they're going to take me a while. The one I'm going to do first is a book on classical Chinese aesthetics. And the reason for that is, you know, when you talk to people and they say, oh, I do Chinese philosophy, usually what they mean is ethics or maybe political philosophy, but, you know, in Chinese philosophy, ethics and political philosophy are pretty close. There is a huge literature about artistic expression, the purposes of art, how you interpret art, how you judge art, that philosophers scarcely pay attention to. And I don't think there's a good reason. I can speculate as to the reasons, but they're not good. And the material is very rich. You know, I wouldn't be devoting time to it if I didn't think so. And so I think that's a project I have to do. It involves a much broader array of sources. You can't get by with 8 sources. I think that's part of the reason why philosophers don't deal with it. Because, you know, Chinese literati had a lot to say about art. Many arts, poetry, music, calligraphy, painting, even dance, even things like landscape architecture, if you go later in time. So I'm going to have to restrict myself basically to the period up to about the Tang. I'll use some Tang sources. I couldn't do more than that, first of all, because my ability doesn't extend, you know, all through the Chinese tradition. You know, we talk about, you know, the Chinese tradition, Chinese history, Chinese philosophy. That's a bit like saying, you know, European tradition, you know, European philosophy. If the European tradition went back to 1600 BC, it's absurd. So, you know, my ability starts to taper off around the Tang Dynasty. And also the book would become too unwieldy because after that we have so many sources. And literati tended to be pretty good writers. So it takes a very long time to read their work, you know, if you're engaging it seriously. But that I'm looking forward to that. It's based on a quartet of lectures that I gave at the Academy of Fine Arts, the Central Academy of Fine Arts in Beijing. In 2 years ago, December of 18. And, I had these ideas and they invited me out of the blue. And I was thinking, okay, this is the foremost art school in China. I've got to go. And I wanted to see how they were going to respond because it's a very American perspective. It's both traditional and American at the same time. So it's based entirely on traditional Chinese texts, but it's not the way they're taught. In China, and the audience was great. I mean, these were members of the faculty, students, practicing artists, art historians. It was just the kind of diverse audience you would want if you were trying out some new ideas. And the positive feedback I got from them convinced me that this is a book that I had to write up. So I'll be working on that in 2021. A lot of it is in my head, so I might actually be able to finish it. If not, then I won't go crazy because it's going to be a complicated book. And then the other thing, the second project, I alluded to that when you asked me about Qi, that's going to be a handbook of Chinese philosophical terms that will lay out for philosophers everything that linguistics has done for us, so that when you get a term like Qi, the range of definitions that you're presented with is not everything from vital breath to psychophysical stuff to all the whole bewildering array of translations of Qi that I listed in that appendix. Rather, you get a linguistically organized history of the word that then also goes into the significant philosophical usages. And for that one, I will have to stop at the end of the classical period, you know, simply because so many of these philosophical terms, like Qi, they're like pearls. They just keep growing and growing and growing and growing because the tradition never dies. And as, later writers keep on using these concepts, they keep on adding more and more nuances, more and more connotations, Buddhism is also a huge source of philosophical vocabulary, especially for Neo-Confucians. So I won't be able to do more than what I conceive is basically the first volume of this that I can handle, and the classical philosophers, and maybe somebody else will have to pick up the thread from there. And that I won't be able to start that until I finish the aesthetics book. So that one won't be around for a while, but I have a pretty definite plan, maybe something like 50 to 80 of the most important terms. And it will also be limited by you know, our linguistic knowledge. There are unfortunately still some words whose etymology is still unclear. It's very frustrating. And it, as I said, it's nothing you encounter when you read Aristotle or you know, even South Asian philosophy. Usually the etymology is pretty well understood, and in China we're still struggling.
That sounds great. I'm looking forward to seeing those when they're finished. So I'd like to thank you again, Paul, for sitting down to discuss your book with me.
Sure, it's been a lot of fun.